pray, Veni Sancte Spiritus. Hear me, my voice is getting worse and worse, particularly after having meals here with 39 nice people shouting. And so I hope you can hear me. In case you can, try to come closer because my vocal cords are very bad. Now I'm tackling an impossible task, a very daring task. Give you some insights into my husband's gigantic book on aesthetics. It's a 1,002-volume, 1,000-page manuscript, which he started at the age of 80, at the very beginning of February, and by the end of May, volume one was completed, for the very plain reason that he had been concerned about aesthetics ever since he was a child, the father of a very famous sculptor, living in Florence, surrounded by beauty. He gave his first public talk at the age of 17 on aesthetics. And so his whole life long, he was concerned about it. And I believe this work to be quite unique for the very plain reason that in contradistinction to most people writing on aesthetics, he's not concerned about sociological questions. He's not concerned about psychological questions. He's not concerned about historical questions, explaining that because this particular artist had this particular experience, then obviously he had to write this particular work. Or you take the gigantic work of Hegel on aesthetics, in which he tries to explain the history of aesthetics by saying it is a development manifestation of the world spirit. And so as the world spirit as first is still imprisoned in matter, the first works are architecture and then sculpture and then finally music, because music is the most liberated from matter. All these are theories. What my husband tries to do is truly analyze the question of beauty. What is beauty? And you will notice that most philosophers escape from the question. You read the whole work, hundreds of pages long, and at the end you say to yourself, when I know certain conditions or certain historical facts, I do not know what beauty is. On the other hand, my husband is quite conscious of the fact that if you try to define beauty, you'll fail. Definition, in fact, is meant for artificial objects. I can define a table, I can define a chair, I can define a computer. But as soon as you turn to essences, which are extremely rich and deep in meaning, a definition will never do it. It is too rich. It cannot be imprisoned simply in one sentence. A typical example is St. Thomas Aquinas' definition of beauty. What is beauty? Quod visu placet, what pleases my eye. Now, this is, of course, an extremely unsatisfactory definition. Why? Because, number one, he excludes, he doesn't mention music, because after all, when I love music, it doesn't please my eye, it pleases my mind, if you want, through my ear. Number two, because there are lots of things that please our eyes for the wrong reason. I mean, you take, for example, the unfortunate people who have a passion for pornography. And if they see a pornographic image, are going to enjoy it. But don't tell me that it is beautiful. Therefore, it's a very, very unsatisfactory approach to what beauty is. Now, because my husband knows this, his analysis of beauty is just going to try to shed light on certain facets of something extremely mysterious called beauty, keeping in mind that God is beauty itself with a capital B, and that human creations or nature as created by God are just reflections of this infinite beauty which is God. Now, in order to make my point clear, I must go back to a distinction that I made at the end of my last talk, namely the distinction between two fundamentally forms or types of beauty. The first one that my husband calls metaphysical beauty is an accompanying phenomenon. Every single time you have an authentic value, whether it's metaphysical or whether it is qualitative. You know, for example, the beauty of man, the beauty of an angel, the beauty of virtue, the beauty of intelligence, and so forth and so on. Beauty is an accompanying phenomenon, and it's never your theme. You should not judge. You could not say, for example, I love this virtue because it is beautiful. But it is beautiful because it's a virtue. And therefore it is a virtue that should attract your interest. There you have a very strict hierarchy. Moral values are more beautiful than intellectual values. God is more beautiful than an angel, more beautiful than man, more beautiful than an animal, and more beautiful than a flower, and then inanimate matter. And therefore, there's always a perfect correspondence between the height of the value and the degree of beauty. On top of it, metaphysical beauty is not sense-perceived. It is something that we understand. When St. Augustine speaks of truth, beauty as being the splendor of truth, this is not something which is physically perceived, sense-perceived. It is something that immense understands. The exclusive concern of my husband in his aesthetics is to turn to a radically different type of beauty that he calls sense-perceived beauty. Because this type of beauty cannot be perceived unless your eyes and ears function normally. If you are blind and deaf, you can have access to metaphysical beauty, but you can never appreciate the beauty of a painting or a piece of music. And that is a type of beauty that he's going to be concerned with in his aesthetics. Now, there is a phenomenon which is very strange. Number one, it's sense-perceived, and if your senses do not function, you're not going to understand it. Number two, there is a total discrepancy between the material used and the degree of beauty. You take, as Cardinal Newman says, there are seven notes in the scale. And from these seven notes, Mozart creates the Ave Verum. Bach creates the Matthäus Passion, the Passion according to St. Matthew. And the discrepancy is so fantastic because the tools used are so insignificant and the result is so amazing. Now, from this point of view, there's something which is very interesting. From a metaphysical point of view, an animal is superior to a plant. From the point of view of sense-perceived beauty, suppose that I show to you a toad and a rose, and I say to you, what is more beautiful? I hope you'll say the rose. And I can prove this to you by saying that if you read poetry, you're going to see that great lovers that happen to be poets will compare their beloved to a rose or to a lily or to violet, but not say you are the best-looking toad. You know, it'd be inconceivable simply because the toad is original-looking, but you cannot say it's a model of beauty. You see, my husband speaks about God's creativity in the sense that it's also inventing. There's also a sense of humor in the creation of hippopotamus or toads, but you cannot say how beautiful. Now, there's another thing which is worth noticing. When I speak about beauty, I speak about a type of value which is going to move me, to affect me, to touch me. Now, even though I do not want to offend mathematicians in this room, and I know that there are some whom I highly respect, I say that suppose that you study algebra or geometry, and you're overwhelmed, you know, by, let us say, the clarity, the necessity. You know, I mean, they are amazing sciences, simply. But you cannot say that you're going to fall into a state of ecstasy, because you discover that the sum of the angles of a triangle are equal to two right angles. And they go wild. Imagine, I mean, this has absolutely revolutionized my life. You know, there's a new light on life because I discovered this mathematical truth. What is amazing about beauty is that it can move you so deeply and so profoundly that actually I know cases of people who have found their way to God, because they were so touched by the phenomenon of beauty. Just a couple of weeks ago, I had the great sadness of losing a very, very dear friend of mine, the prior of the Carthusian Monastery in Vermont, the first monastery created in the United States about 25 or 30 years ago. And he was my husband's godchild, he was Jewish, entered the church after taking my husband's courses for about 18 months, and told him that he was a naval officer in the Pacific in the Second World War. And one very fine day, he saw a sunset that was so overwhelming that he stood on desk, transfixed, and simply said, "Now, this cannot be just a combination of gases. There's something back of it." And then he was discharged and started studying philosophy at Columbia. And thank God, was bitterly disillusioned. And one very fine day, someone said to him, "You know, there's someone called Dietrich von Lieben teaching at Fordham. Why don't you sit in his classes?" And he had the very same response that I had the very moment he heard my husband talk. He says, "That's what I was looking for." Now, therefore, for him, the phenomenon of beauty, the overwhelming beauty of a sunset, was his way to God. And then when he discovered that God was beauty itself, then he decided to give his whole life to God and became a Carthusian. Now, therefore, you see the difference between these two types of beauty. And now I'm going to concentrate exclusively on sense-perceived beauty revealed to us through our eyes and ears. But please keep in mind that when I say we need the integrity of our senses in order to perceive beauty, sense, whether it is music, whether it is architecture, painting, or sculpture, whatever it is, nevertheless, it is not the sense perceived beauty, the beauty coming through my senses. But my senses are just a window to another world. In other words, it's a very profound and subtle intellectual process taking place, and it is simply because this beauty is accessible to us through our senses, but then would come from our senses. You see, there's a tremendous difference whether I hear cacophony, I hear rock and roll, and I run off as fast as I can, not because it is hurting my eardrum, as when I have an earache, and then the pain is located in my ear, but I simply understand this music to be devilish, and I run off. And therefore, you see the tremendous, it's not coming, it is coming through our senses, but it's not a sense-perceived message in this sense. There's a whole intellectual and spiritual world that opens up. Now, I just said a moment ago, beauty, as opposed to an intellectual discovery in logic or in mathematics, is going to touch me, to affect me, to move me. I mean, as a matter of fact, which one of us hasn't cried, hasn't been moved to tears by beauty? It can be the Passion according to St. Matthew of Bach, it can be a quartet of Mozart or Schubert or whatever it might be, a magnificent poet. And then you read it and you are so moved that tears come to your eyes. Now, this is the interesting point, the very moment that my feelings are involved. The one dogma prevalent in our society is that, therefore, beauty is purely subjective. Because obviously it moves me and my feelings are subjective feelings and my feelings are not your feelings, and therefore there is no ground for an objective discussion. You know, that was one of the dogmas in Hunter. Now, of course, it was a universal dogma that applied to moral values. But in moral values, you have a cloud that you cannot use in aesthetics. This is why I always found aesthetics particularly difficult to teach. Because, for example, my students will say to me, all moral values are relative. And then I discovered that one of my students, ardently defending the subjectivism of all values, subjectivity of all values, was Jewish. And then I say, you know, I never expected anyone in my classroom to defend the Holocaust. That did the trick. All of a sudden, there was one exception. There was one thing that actually was bad in itself. That was the Holocaust. You see, therefore, I had a possibility of reaching them. But if you say, as one of my students said, I think that Shakespeare was a very bad writer. Now, what sort of argument can you give to that fool? You can't give an argument. I mean, try it and you're going to see it's not going to succeed. The only thing that I do is that I become gently cynical. And then I said, what a blow to Shakespeare that Mr. Cohn of the Bronx thinks that it doesn't write well. And then I proceed. But there's no argument. What sort of argument can I possibly give? You can't. And therefore the question is, aesthetics is either you see or you do not see. And if you do not see, my advice to you is don't talk about things that you do not perceive. But it's another peculiar urge of people to speak about the things that they know nothing about. And you will notice that is a curse of philosophy. I mean, philosophers are cursed beings, because suppose, for example, that someone in this room were discussing nuclear physics. Now, I have to confess that I know nothing about it, absolutely nothing. So I'll be wise enough to say nothing, because otherwise I'll make an idiot of myself. But to discuss a philosophical question, the existence of God, or the immortality of the soul, or the objectivity of moral values, and then you're sure to find someone who's going to say, I never studied philosophy, but my opinion is so-and-so. And then you get some sort of nonsense. I mean, in other words, as soon as we turn to philosophical questions, everybody feels competent. And that is a curse of philosophy. It doesn't cross their head that maybe a little bit of thinking about the subject is going to help. No, that's how they feel. And in a democratic society, you have to respect another person's opinion. Now, I always said to my students, I have the deepest respect for you, but I have no respect for stupidity. You know, no one in the name of democracy can say to me, you have to respect stupidity because I produced it. I respect you, but not your products, because I'm just too stupid. Now, at any rate, the difficulty is that beauty is going to be related to feelings. But now my husband is going to say, I perceive an object of beauty, a sunset, here a magnificent poem, a piece of music, a magnificent painting. And what is going to happen? I'll perceive it and I'll be moved by it. And I mean, the keener my sensitivity, the keener my artistic development, the purer my response. But my husband insists upon the fact that this response is a response to an object calling for this response. If I rave about something ugly, I give a response that I should not be giving, because ugliness or bad taste doesn't call for that sort of response. And therefore, the more sensitive you are to beauty, the more there's going to be a harmony between the object and your response. But your response is directed to the object, and the object should remain your essential main concern, not your response. Now, there comes an extremely interesting moment, at the very moment that people are moved because of psychiatry, because of modern psychology, because of our incredible subjectivism today. They become much more interested in what's going on in them than in the object. And then you fall into subjectivism. Now, what my husband tried to do is to find, are there objective standards enabling us to distinguish between what is beautiful and not beautiful? And he rambles on for pages and pages of admirable analysis. I can only choose a couple of gems that I'll share with you. And he has discovered that there are at least 5 negative standards that are opposed to beauty, to such an extent that each time that you find each one of these, you say, this is not beautiful. And then he discovers further that each one of these negative standards leads people to a false reaction to another negative standard that seems to oppose the first one, and in fact is doing the very same thing. You see, in other words, what my husband has discovered, and see that he's gone through the history of philosophy, that someone says one nonsense, and there are plenty of it in the history of philosophy. The next moment, someone opposes this nonsense by producing another nonsense, which is just as bad. But because it is opposed to the first one, they simply say, no, I have found the truth. This is why he said, truth is never between two errors. It is above it. You see, therefore, the whole business today of the pendulum, we go too far on the left, and then we go too far on the right, and then comes the blessing, then we come to the middle. It's not a question of the middle. It is a question of truth, which is higher or deeper, but never between two errors. Now, I just have very little time to discuss some of them, but I mean, basically, when you have five wrong standards, and for each one of them, you have two erroneous responses, then obviously you have 15 wrong standards that you can use. Well, I'm just going to discuss, I mean, as much time as I have, one or two. And one of them is sentimentality. Now, I have mentioned a moment ago that obviously beauty calls for an affective response, a response of my heart, as opposed just to my intellect. It moves me. But you will notice that one of the things which is so terribly widespread in art, and I immediately say to you, bad art, is sentimentality. Now, basically, what is sentimentality? Some people believe that it is just an exaggerated sensitivity. This is not the case. It's not a question of just being too emotional, that it is simply a question of having the wrong type of emotion. You know full well that in the history of philosophy, and this is to be traced back to Aristotle, feelings have not been well treated. You see, when you read Plato, you read his Phaedrus, which I consider to be one of his finest and deepest works, he says, love is the greatest of heaven's blessings. Therefore, he places a feeling, because you can say what you please, but love is a feeling. It's not only a feeling, but it's a feeling. It is the highest of heaven's blessings. Then you turn to Aristotle, and he tells us in his Ethics that what distinguishes between man and animals is that men have an intelligence and have will. And then he has this unfortunate sentence, which, being a genius, sometimes he corrects because he forgets what he has said. He says, feelings are things that we share with animals. Now, my husband has written a whole book on that, which I consider to be one of his great works, called The Heart, in which he makes a distinction between three fundamentally different types of feelings. And the first are physical feelings located in my body. I have pain in my stomach, and I go to the doctor and I say, I have pain. He says, where? And then I show my stomach, and I say, that's where the pain is from. Or you feel hungry. You're conscious of your body craving for something. You feel thirsty. You feel tired. These are feelings that are related to my body and that an angel hasn't got. And these are things we share with animals. The feeling of pain, physical pain, is something we share with animals, even though my husband says, because a human being is a human being, pain has a very different character. But nevertheless, an animal can cry, can scream, because he's suffering pains. If you beat him, he'll scream. Now, this is one type of feeling. There's another type of feeling. You know, and you will notice that in order for me to feel pain in my stomach, I need not know what is the cause of it. Therefore, my husband calls it unintentional. I have a fearful pain in my stomach. I scream from pain. And someone says to me, what is the matter with you? I say, I don't know. I just know that I have pain. So I'm going to the doctor who is supposed to tell me why I have pain or what is the cause of my pain. And sometimes they will say to you, I don't know either. There is another type of feeling which is very different. I'm just going to take one example to illuminate. You drink too much, and then you fall into an extremely joyful, you know, I know people, they drink one glass of wine, they start singing and embracing anyone else. You see, this is, of course, in the operetta of Johann Strauss, Die Fledermaus. and everybody's drinking, then at the end of the day, everybody's kissing everyone else, and everybody's his friend, so forth and so on. Now, don't tell me that this is a deep, profound human relationship. It's something very, very superficial, but nevertheless, when you happen to be in this type of a mood, all of a sudden you're going to see, oh, you love the whole world, and everybody's marvelous, you see. You're okay, and I'm okay, you know, and everybody's okay. This is non-intentional once again, because you need not know that you happen to be in this jolly mood because you drank too much. So I say to you, beware of one too many glass of wine. This is a phenomenon that can be easily created, that suddenly you see, I'm quoting Faust, you know, Goethe's Faust, when he says, if you give this drink to this particular person, every ugly woman is going to be transformed into Helena. You know, all of a sudden you see her as being absolutely beautiful because you are slightly drunk. Now, this is a type of feeling which is definitely not spiritual, but nevertheless we all know it. You know, it can also be a depression because you are anemic. And you're terribly depressed, and then you find out that you are so anemic that your body doesn't function. You see, once again, it's non-intentional. But then comes a type of feelings that animals haven't got. A feeling which is a response to an object. And this feeling can be adequate or can be inadequate. Suppose, for example, that I find out that another person has been promoted. And my response is depression, not why not myself. Well, obviously, if someone has been promoted and the person deserves it, we should give a response of joy, because there'll be harmony between the object and my response. I know people who get dreadfully depressed when their best friend gets engaged. And why should I be a wallflower and she gets engaged? And they fall into depression. Now, normally, if you have a friend and this friend is blessed with a beautiful engagement, I mean, the response should be joy. So therefore, man is capable of giving the wrong response. Like this student of mine who professed atheism. And he had been quite nice through the... I was teaching veterans. I mean, just to tell you, my career hasn't been very pleasant or very easy. But when you're a young girl, 24 years old, and you teach 150 veterans just coming back from the war, and you discover what veterans can be like, believe me, it was not easy. And I had one student who was fairly cooperative and nice and seemed to be interested in philosophy. The others, when I said God or good and so on, they shouted me down practically. So it always took me back to the subway. I was teaching in Hunter Uptown, and at night it was not very pleasant to go there, and he always accompanied me to the subway, for which I was grateful. And at the end of the semester, typically me, I say, well, I'm just going to tackle God's existence. You know, that's a good ending for my course of introduction. And the moment I hinted at the fact that there was a God or gave arguments, this man started to shut me down practically. And I was amazed because he had been polite the whole semester long, and I wasn't used to it. So I said, today's not going to take me to the subway. He was downstairs waiting for me. It was a bitterly cold winter night, and the sky was magnificent, as it can be in New York sometimes, a sort of dark blue, and there was the moon shining. And we're silent for a while, and then I looked up, I said, look how magnificent it is. And he raised his fist, and he said that he could make it, and I can't. That was an eye-opener for me. And then I just said very quietly, no, I understand your opposition to my arguments today. You see, in other words, he saw the glory of God. And instead of saying, heaven and earth are full of your glory, he said, I can't do it. You see, therefore, man is capable of giving the wrong response to an object. But then suppose that you give the right response to an object. Suppose that your response is perfectly in harmony, adequate to the call of the object. In this very moment, in some way, you touch what is deepest in man's soul, a feeling. And this feeling presupposes knowledge, because obviously it presupposes a vision of something which calls for this response. Therefore, it includes the intellectual element. Number two, it presupposes my affectivity, my heart moved by it. And number three, and this is one of the great contributions of my husband, my will. has to consolidate this opinion. It's not enough for me to give a response which is affective if I do not nail it with my will and say, not only I'm giving this response, but I want to give it. It's going to evaporate. And this is a reason why I believe feelings have been so badly treated in the history of philosophy. And simply say, you know, they come and go. I mean, you cannot base your spiritual life on feeling. Now, when St. John tells us God is love, well, then obviously this is more than just an intellectual knowledge. You've got to love God. And to love God means a total donation, not only of my mind and my will, but my heart. You read the Old Testament. And it says, my son, give me your heart. If you ever fall in love, the blessing of falling in love, you're going to say to your beloved, you're not going to say to her, I give you my intellect. I mean, I'd love to see the face of a woman whose fiancé says, I'm giving you my intellect. Well, you'll see what she's going to say, but she's going to say, I'm giving you my heart.